From the studios of KUSP Radio in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. John Strasbaugh is my guest. He is the author of many books about stuff that I find interesting. They include Alone with the President, Rock Till You Drop, The Decline from Rebellion to Nostalgia, Black Like You, Blackface, Whiteface, Insult and Imitation in American Popular Culture, and a lot of other things. His new book is the mammoth The Village, 400 Years of Beats and Bohemians, Radicals and Rogues, A History of Greenwich Village. John Strasbaugh, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks a bunch. How are you, Gary?
I'm good, thank you. Your book, The Village, 400 Years of Beats and Bohemians, Radicals and Rogues, A History of Greenwich Village, is bookended by plague. How did plague help make Greenwich Village?
Yeah, it's Greenwich Village was always, from the very beginning, a refuge for in various ways for misfits, outcasts, or people just running away from things. Back when New York City was still very tiny and all crammed down into the lowest tip of Manhattan, because everybody was jammed together down there, cholera, yellow fever, other epidemic diseases broke out every year, basically. And people who could would run out to the countryside. At that point, Greenwich Village was still a couple miles outside of town, and it was the countryside. So people would flee there. There was a huge epidemic in 1822, and at that point, people started building permanently in the village to stay outside of the city. They were just giving up on the city.
So the village was uptown at that point.
Yeah, yeah. At that point, let's see, 1822, the city did not go up much, very far above, say, Wall Street. I mean, it was a little farther up, but not very far. The city really starts booming and growing in the 1820s and 1830s and races up the island after that. But until then, New York City and before that, New Amsterdam are all crammed down in the tip, and everything else is wilderness and then becomes farmland and countryside and country estates. Washington Square Park was a burial ground originally for yellow fever and cholera victims and indigents and unknown people who died, because it was far enough outside of town that they thought it was safe to bury those people out there.
Do you think they're still buried there under there?
When they turned it into, first it got turned into a military parade ground, and then it got turned into a park. They were constantly kind of breaking through the ground into those graves, and they're pretty sure there's still people down there.
Yeah, well, I noticed downtown recently, over by Wall Street, there's an African burial ground now that's become a national park that they thought.
And it may be the oldest. I think it is the oldest. Jewish cemetery is way downtown in Manhattan, too. They were Sephardic Jews, and they were the first ones. They came from, I guess, Brazil, and they were the first ones into New York. I've said this before, anywhere you step in New York City, you're stepping on a dead person one way or another.
What a pleasant thought. Another wonderful thought about Manhattan. And so then plague also is responsible for the demise of the village. How so?
The plague of AIDS. It was because Greenwich Village was the epicenter of gay culture on the East Coast, and actually for the eastern half of the United States. Everybody east of the Mississippi was, if they could, they were going to go live in or right around Greenwich Village. So it was the epicenter of the AIDS plague on the East Coast. And as part of that, by the mid-80s, as a direct result of that, by the mid-80s, a whole lot of people had simply died. Others moved out because it was a dead zone and they just didn't want to be there anymore. Everywhere they stepped, they were seeing somebody, some place where a friend of theirs had lived before who wasn't around anymore. As they were moving out, the prices were shooting up and the professional classes were starting to move in because the village has always been this lovely ye olde Greenwich Village, with the nice streets and the trees and the little houses that you don't get anywhere else in Manhattan, or at least lower Manhattan. And as the prices went up, artists, creative people, the people who had defined Greenwich Village, were forced out.
So it's a 400-year history, but you feel it's virtually over now.
I think so. It has been declared dead. I've said this before, too. Every generation who misspent their youth there, when they grew out of it, they declared it dead. And that was a premature death sentence many times. But I think maybe now it is, because artists, creative people, intellectuals, bohemians need cheap places to live and work, because making culture and making money don't go together in America, or very rarely. And the prices have soared so amazingly in Manhattan. They shot up in the 2000s as a result of that general housing bubble that we went through up till the crash of 2008, that Greenwich Village can't attract misfits anymore. It can only attract millionaires. You have to have a ton of money to live in Greenwich Village now. And artists don't have a ton of money very often unless they're Lady Gaga or somebody.
Well, it's not in the Village, but you talk a little bit about, or you talk all about all of Manhattan, because, you know, everything is affected.
Yeah.
But when you talk about the kind of rebirth under Koch, but then really under Giuliani, of the Times Square area and Broadway.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's something, even though, you know, it was disgusting and horrible and gross, but yet something is lost in the getting rid of all of the sleaziness?
I think what a lot of cities have been going through, and not just in North America, but we're seeing it in Europe as well, and other places. It's been a trend in the late 20th and now early 21st century to homogenize cities. They've become almost interchangeable. You can be walking now along the waterfront of Manhattan and think you're in San Diego. And that's happening everywhere. You can be in San Diego and think you're walking by the Thames. There's that corporate globalized homogenizing that's been going on that has, it preserves local color only as an attraction for tourists now. And yes, I think a tremendous amount is lost that way. What people in the Village who managed to hang on in the Village, mostly because they have rent-subsidized apartments, has said to me was that, yes, it was dirty and funky and kind of beat up, but, you know, funk has its place. And artists, let's face it, tend to like funk. They tend to like things a little beat up, a little not pretty and nice and family-oriented and Disney-fied, and I think most of our cities have become Disney-fied now.
I was walking through the Village I think it was probably in the late 80s, and there were some boys, and they were playing hacky sack, and I thought, oh, look how cute they are. Then I realized it was a rat that they were kicking around.
Ah, that's a great story. I wish I'd known that one. When I do the paperback, I'll put that in there.
Okay. So there's so many stories. There are really, it was like 400 biographies in your book.
That's tons, yeah.
Who did you learn of that you didn't know about going in?
Oh, almost every day I was like, what? P.G. Woodhouse lived in Greenwich Village? Harry Belafonte had a hamburger stand in Greenwich Village? It's just every day. I knew, because we all know, that there were tons and tons of creative people who at least passed through Greenwich Village at one point in the 20th century. But I swear, there were times when it seemed like anybody who was anybody in Western civilization in the 20th century spent some time in Greenwich Village. It just goes on and on. Edgar Varese and Maya Deren and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, not just artists, but artists, writers, intellectuals, philosophers, the entire 30s generation of European art and intellectualism, when they fled the Nazis, they came naturally first to New York City. Many of them stayed, and many of them were gravitated toward the Village. It never ends.
We're talking to John Strasbaugh, and his new book is called The Village, 400 Years of Beats and Bohemians, Radicals and Rogues, A History of Greenwich Village. Well, there's always some debate about when you're in the Village and when you're not in the Village. What do you think are the geographical boundaries?
Well, you know, the good thing about neighborhoods is that we all get to say what the neighborhood is. There's no official version of what it is. I think everybody pretty much agrees that it's below 14th Street, and now most everybody would agree for the last 30, 40 years that it's above Houston Street. It wasn't always that way. The river is obviously that end of it. And then it's that eastern edge. I say it ends at Broadway. Other people say it goes all the way over to the Bowery, which I don't think is right, but that's their opinion. So for the purpose of the book, I made it Broadway. That way you're doing you're including Washington Square Park and the sort of patrician Henry James village, but you're also getting the old Italian village, the Irish village, the Bohemian village, and the Black village, which, you know, all at different times, well, sometimes coterminously existed.
There are so many places in the village that were landmark places that are now disappearing and being replaced. And in fact, I think the White Horse Tavern is closed. Yes?
No, it's still there.
Thank God. But it's right across from that cupcake place where people are lined up.
The cupcake place. The Magnolia place. Listen, they're great cupcakes. You know, I don't want to knock them for that. But I, as I was doing the interviews of people who live there now or lived there recently, over and over and over again, I heard about the cupcake place because it was in Sex and the City.
Oh.
Sex and the City had a tremendous impact on Manhattan. Everywhere those girls went or were supposed to have lived became a tourist attraction. And it had an effect on certainly on Greenwich Village.
So if they had gone to the White Horse Tavern, that would have been a good thing. But instead, they went to the Fakakta Cupcake Place, which
there
is now...
There you go.
There's a line there at 3 o'clock in the morning to get in.
They literally bus tourists up to that place. And they all get out of the bus and eat a cupcake and take their pictures eating cupcakes because Samantha or one of them used to do it.
The village was not always known as the village. It was known by its political designation for a long time.
Yeah, the name starts very kind of murkily. It was probably Groenwijk, the Dutch, which basically just means greenwood. And then it got anglicized when the English took over and became Greenwich. And because it was outside of town, it became Greenwich Village. But people really didn't use that term very much. Until the early 20th century. In the 1900s, most people referred... There was no Lower East Side either. People didn't refer to it that way. Most people referred to where they lived by the wards that they were in, the political subdivisions. So the village was the 9th Ward, which was a kind of more working-class Irish ward, and the 15th Ward, which was called the Yankee Ward, or the Empire Ward, because it was where the Henry James types lived, the upper crust were. And actually, the name Greenwich Village becomes ubiquitously known as part of in the 1920s, they started marketing it as Ye Olde Greenwich Village, and that's when we all get to be calling it that.
The Ninth Ward, what kind of a political place was it?
It was very Tammany Hall because it was very Irish. There was a house there that was called Little Tammany Hall because it had more people voting the Tammany ticket than actually lived there. Tammany was huge all over Lower Manhattan, all through the 18th, the 19th century. And Tammany was one of the biggest, most powerful political machines in the country. Only Chicago, I think, could have rivaled it. It was very heavily Irish for a very long time. So anywhere there were large concentrations of Irish folks, you had a solid voting block for Tammany Hall. And in the 1920s, Jimmy Walker, who grew up in the village, Tammany made him the mayor to preside over the Prohibition years in the Roaring Twenties in New York. And they couldn't have, if they'd gone to central casting, they couldn't have found a better mayor. He was in speakeasies more often than he was in the office.
And on the waterfront, the characters in On the Waterfront are kind of drawn from villagers?
The whole from the village up through Chelsea and Hell's Kitchen was that whole waterfront was very solidly Irish from the 1800s on, and so there was a lot of gangsterism, there was a lot of graft, greed, corruption. It was a pretty wicked place. Cops would never walk over there by themselves because they were as likely to get knocked over the head and had their coat stolen as a civilian would. So, and it's where the term paddy wagon comes from, and Donnybrook comes from over there. There was a series of articles in the 1940s that was first beginning to expose the corruption and graft and greed on the waterfront, and it became the movie On the Waterfront.
There's three books that came out recently about the village in the last few years that I love, and you quote them all in your book, so I know you intimately familiar with them, and that is Susie Rotolo's book, A Free Will and Time, and then Patti Smith's book, which everybody loves, The Just Kids, and Bob Dylan's Chronicles, Volume 1, although so far there's only Volume 1, but maybe we'll get Volume 3 coming soon.
Or he'll jump to volume 6 and then he'll do something Dylan.
It's the only autobiography in which you know less about the writer when you're done than you did when
you
were. But they do, all three of them paint interesting pictures of the village, and the village is a place where music, you know, folk music, punk rock, so many different kinds of music.
Folk rock, jazz, traditional jazz, bebop, may never have gotten to be as big as it was in the late 40s and 50s had it not been for the way that it found tremendous fans in Greenwich Village and in what's now called the East Village. It was in Harlem. It was being played in clubs in other cities around the country, but like at 2 a.m., and only the musicians were hearing it. And had they not come down and found their audiences, their white, hip, bohemian audiences, I don't know that bebop would have gotten to be as big as it was.
There's so many albums that were recorded in the village, like Coltrane, all those ones, Gate, and all those, pretty amazing.
The Village Vanguard's been there since 1934. It was not a jazz club for a long, long time, but that's one of the oldest. It is the oldest nightclub in New York. It's such an institution in the village, and it's still there, and it's running every night.
I just read where Izzy Young, of the Folklore Center in the village, has a manuscript to an unpublished Bob Dylan song, which Christie's is going to auction for $50,000, and Young says it'll be the first time he's ever had any money.
See, and that's what I'm saying, and that's why those cheap rents were really important. Nobody was making money, or very few people were making money. The entire Folkways catalog of over 1,000 records happened with, you know, nobody ever made a penny off that stuff. You're thinking Izzy Young, he had the Folklore Center,
right?
And he has since moved. Now he lives in where? He's in Copenhagen or somewhere.
Oh,
he lives in Europe somewhere. He finally moved out. He moved around to a couple different places in the village. But his place, he wasn't making any money there. It was a place where Dave Van Ronk was hanging out, and Dylan met him there, and guys would come by and get their mail when they were on tour. And the whole village existed on very little money for a very long time.
One of my favorite entertainers who gets a mention in The Village, 400 Years of Beats and Bohemians, Radicals and Rogues, The History of Greenwich Village, is Professor Irwin Corey. I loved him.
Yeah, he's great. He's still around. There was just an article in the Times, it was about 6 months ago, I think, where a very good Times writer who's good at keeping up with the old-timers, Corey Kilgannon, was just driving up 2nd Avenue or 3rd Avenue, Midtown Manhattan, and saw Irwin Corey panhandling in the middle of the street.
Oh, my
God.
But
not because he needs the money. Oh. He does it and sends the money to Cuba because he's an old-school New York City socialist.
Well, good for him. Mm. He's the world's foremost authority, as we all know.
Yes, he is.
What about writers? I guess there were a few writers that lived in the village, Edgar Allan Poe.
It goes back to Tom Paine, Edgar Allan Poe. And once again, they're all sort of outcasts, misfits, pains in the butt in one way or another. Tom Paine, people were punning on his name back then about what a pain was. And it goes from them straight to Walt Whitman. He didn't live there, but he came and hung out because it was where to go and meet people like him. And then it goes, you know, it's just dozens and dozens through the Edna St. Vincent Millay generation, Eugene O'Neill, up through Norman Mailer and Ginsberg, and just almost everybody who was writing in New York at least were carousing and drinking in the village, and many of them were living in the village.
And hanging out with each other.
And that's another important thing. You know, people, there's been this big debate over the last, you know, since we've all gone digital, is there a need for geographic bohemias and art neighborhoods anymore? And a lot of people would say no, because you meet up, you know, on Facebook, and you're hashtagging and Twittering and tweeting each other. I don't think it's the same as rubbing elbows at the bar with each other. You argue with each other, you're fighting, you're making friends, you're looking at what you walk next door and look at what that guy's doing. If they're putting on a performance, they can recruit you. One guy does the paints and she does the booklet, and that used to go on all the time. Kenneth Coke, the poet in the village, said that it was fizzy with collaboration in the early 50s. And that lasted into the 60s and then started to die off.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine Kerouac writing online instead of on the road, though.
It's hard to picture, isn't it?
I don't think that would have happened.
I think it's important. I think physical contact, you know, I'm afraid that we're developing vestigial faces at this point in our culture. No one seems to even know how to make a face anymore because they're so busy moving their thumbs around on their handheld devices. But I think it's that contact is really important.
It's like technology is a wonderful thing. So many of our listeners right now are listening online or listening via
yep.
technology. But it's like a virus that is like spreading throughout our culture and destroying
it. I love the Internet. I have no problem with the Internet. It's in the last several years, it's become indispensable to me as a reference library and a used bookstore. But you can't spend all your time there. I think you need to. We're human beings. We still need human contact. At least, you know, at this point. Maybe 100 years from now, nobody will. But I think we do. And I think, especially if you're creative people, philosophical people, intellectual people, you need to be having conversations and arguments. And I don't know that you can do that online.
You mentioned a bookstore. There were so many great bookstores in the village where you could go in and talk to the people there,
and
learn about the history of the village from them. Was, you know, that can't happen anymore if you're just...
No, they're all gone. Right. They're all Brooks Brothers and Maternity Ward, Maternity Clothes Shops. And it's become very family-oriented, very high-end, affluent family-oriented neighborhood.
My favorite, I'm sure it's gone, but I think it was on 9th, and it was called the Biography Bookstore.
Yeah, no, gone. Loved
it. It was great. Yeah. Now they have a cupcake place there.
Probably, yeah.
we're talking to John Strasbaugh. What about artists?
From very early on, it was attracting artists because there was a lot of cheap boarding houses and rooming houses. A lot of artists were attracted there before the Civil War. And then by the 1910s, there's a huge arts community there. And then it comes back during the Second World War in the late 40s as the abstract expressionist New York school. There wouldn't be... You could make the argument that had there not been a Greenwich Village and East Village at that point, where the rents were cheap, where you could rent a loft that you could live and paint your giant abstract expressionist paintings in, there may not have been an American avant-garde art movement as there was in the late 40s and early 50s, and New York never would have become the art capital of the world that it was by the 60s.
Yeah, you were saying that people of that era, you know, I don't know if we want to call them art lovers, art connoisseurs, were not at all ready for Jackson Pollock or...
Oh, no, it took forever. For the longest time, and that's another reason it's important that they were all in the same neighborhood, because they were their own only audience for the longest time. They had their own art galleries. They did little cooperative art galleries in storefronts. They all went to the openings. Nobody else did. The Uptown Press was not writing about that stuff for a while. And Pollock is the first one who becomes... The press did what the press often does. They picked one, and he became the star. And right away they were saying, is this man the greatest artist in America? And they were saying it in that way that the mainstream would have said it back then, which the implied answer was, no, of course not. Because they didn't really like what he was doing, but they saw that it was creating a stir. And then it built and built, and then finally, you know, it's not until the 1960s, and was more pop art than abstract expressionism, that collecting art, knowing about art, being a connoisseur of art, became something that was hip to do in America. Before that, it was a very... Marcel Duchamp once was asked how many Americans cared about modern art, and he said, I think 5 or 6 in Manhattan and 2 or 3 in Jersey. And that was in, like, the 1940s.
Yeah. And the other night, or a few weeks ago, everything is the other day for me, but a few weeks ago...
I hear you.
A few weeks ago, President Obama was praising the Jason Collins of the Celtics and the Wizards, a basketball player who came out of the closet and became the first openly gay professional sportsman. And I don't think that would have happened if not for the village, and the beginning of the gay rights movement is really right there.
I think you have to include San Francisco as well.
Mm-hmm.
Between the two of them, between the village and the North Beach and other areas in San Francisco, one has to bear in mind that if you were in any way, hip was not hip in America until, say, the 1960s, 1970s. If you were gay, if you were lesbian, if you maybe didn't buy into the Protestant work ethic, if you didn't want to get married and raise kids, if you wanted to be a painter or, God forbid, a poet, you were a pretty lonely outcast in, you know, in almost anywhere in America, except for these tiny little outposts. Greenwich Village was one, and it was a very important one. And once again, it has a long history. It was known as a kind of refuge for gay men and lesbians before they were even calling themselves gay men and lesbians by the mid-1800s. Then, very quietly and slowly, the gay liberation movement is building through the 50s in San Francisco and in Greenwich Village, and then explodes in 1969 with the Stonewall uprising. And from then on, the village is the epicenter, at least on the East Coast, of the whole gay liberation movement and the gay rights movement.
Can you tell us just in a capsule about the riots?
Stonewall was a very funky bar run by mafia guys, because the mafia ran all the gay bars in the city, because for the longest time you couldn't get a license. So they would run them. Who's going to run an illegal bar? The mafia. They know how to do it. They know how to pay off the cops. They know how to handle all that. So they ran virtually all the gay bars in town for the longest time. And not because they had any sympathy or liking for gay guys. And so they were very rude and not very nice to their clientele. And it was a summer night in the summer of 1969. It was mostly younger gay guys who were attracted there, and a lot of drag queens and street queens, because they couldn't go to anywhere else. So they were in there. The cops were busting it all the time. The guys running the place were mean to them, and they just had it. And for 3-4 nights, they rioted in the streets. And at first it kind of didn't make much of an impression. It took a couple of weeks for people to realize what had happened. After years and years and years and years of very politely marching in picket lines and things like that, suddenly people called it the Bunker Hill of gay liberation. And there was just an explosion after that. Gay organizations were founded practically every day. They started working on the laws. They started changing the licensing of bars. Everything happens in the 1970s as a result of those 3-4 nights in 1969.
It's interesting how prohibition of any kind leads to organized crime.
Isn't it amazing? They ran all the speakeasies. To this day, the mafia is, you know, behind a lot of nightclubs and a lot of places you go, and the mafia is in there somewhere. It wasn't just the speakeasies or the gay bars. It's the bars and nightclubs and restaurants to this day.
They're probably behind all those Hooters that are showing up on.
Wouldn't that make sense?
I can never figure out in New York why anybody would go to any kind of fast food restaurant when right next door you could get, you know, something so much better made by people.
I remember when the first, what are they called, apple trees? Apple?
Apple, yeah, I know what you mean.
What do you know?
You people know what we're talking about. Apple, whatever.
Applebee's.
That's
when the first one of those opened below 14th Street in Manhattan, everyone was just appalled. It was like, what? And now they're everywhere. Starbucks is on every corner.
That's so crazy. Starbucks, how they ever made an inroad in Manhattan.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. Well, John Strasbaugh is the author. The book is called The Village, 400 Years of Beats and Bohemians, Radicals and Rogues, A History of Greenwich Village. It's a big old book. If you've ever wanted to, you know, time travel and walk back the streets of the village in some era in the last 400 years, John Strasbaugh gives you the next best thing in this fabulous book. Thanks for writing it.
Oh, thanks for reading it.
And thanks for being here on From the Bookshelf. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again when it comes out in paperback and has my stories in it.
There you go. I'll let you know. Thanks a million.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can find us at www.fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe on iTunes and find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, John Strasbaugh. His book is called The Village, 400 Years of Beats and Bohemians, Radicals and Rogues, A History of Greenwich Village. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas, and I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.